Let's move this bill.
Muscoumine Judiciary come to order. It is May 19th, 2015. The first item, we're going to go to the bottom of the agenda and open with Senate Bill 908A, public hearing.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 908A comes from the Senate Judiciary Committee. This bill has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. The bill amends Oregon's expungement statute. It was the product of a work group between ODAA and OCDLA. The bill cleans up some duplicative and repetitive provisions, and it also provides four modifications. The bill is ready to move.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Lowe and Ms. Meyer, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This actually is a very momentous moment. This is the culmination of a four-year work group on rewriting expungement laws. And the very first work group was amassed by Bill Taylor, and I think there were probably 30 people in the room. I mean, the sheriffs were there. Everybody was there. And after a while, they realized, well, this is just really between the criminal defense lawyers and the DAs. And so then from there, we got together, and we kept knocking heads. The intent here was to rewrite the expungement statute in a way that was readable to the layperson so that they could access the statute and figure out for themselves whether or not they were eligible to have their conviction or their arrest set aside or not. The underlying expungement statute had been amended so many times and in so many discrete ways that we considered it a Frankenstein, and you just really couldn't figure it out. In any event, at some point, we had to appoint our two point guards. And so OCDLA appointed Alex Bassos, and ODAA appointed Jeffrey Lowe, who was here from Multnomah County DA. And finally, the two of them went into a deep, dark chamber that I don't know where it was, and they came out with this bill. And so happily, I'm here to tell you that finally, both of the associations have endorsed the product. And so what Senate Bill 908 does do is it de-Frankensteins the underlying expungement statute, and each side, so to speak, got two new fixes. So with that, I'll let Mr. Lowe explain what those two new fixes are.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Lowe, L-O-W-E. I'm from 4940 Northeast 36th Avenue in Portland, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I am currently a Deputy District Attorney where I've been working for the last 15 years. Also here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We support Senate Bill 908. As already Ms. Meyer has indicated, it does five things, and you've heard the first, it de-Frankensteins it. Makes it clear so that people will understand what they are reading. As a prosecutor in Multnomah County, I handle all of the expungement requests right now. I see 150 applications per month, and the vast majority of those people are not represented by counsel. I think it's important that they're able to read the statute, understand what it says, so they can apply at the right time, and I don't have to send them a nasty letter saying, I'm sorry, you don't really qualify under the statute. This amendment will, in fact, make it much more clear. It puts all of the particular charges in the same place, including their exceptions when there are some, and reduces the size of the statute considerably and makes it easy for people to understand. The second change to the statute is with regards to the possession of a controlled substance in Schedule 1. That's a B felony under Oregon law, and right now it takes 20 years before you are eligible to seek and set aside of that conviction. Schedule 1 controlled substances are obviously the big one. Heroin would include a lot of your biological materials, such as magic mushrooms. It also includes peyote, LSD. Party drugs like ecstasy, which is 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine, methylone, which is bath salts, and a number of other drugs. That's all Schedule 1. Schedule 2 is a lot of your opiates like opium and cocaine and oxycodone and fentanyl. Methamphetamine is a Schedule I, but it's classified as a Class C felony. So it qualifies to be expunged after 3 years, just like coke and opium. Meanwhile, all these other drugs in Schedule I, you've got to wait 20 years. We think it's the right thing to do to make all possession cases eligible after 3 years. And that's why this particular amendment has that language in it today. The third thing that we are trying to address by this amendment is capturing both the letter of the law and the spirit of the law with regards to probation revocations. The purpose of the statute is to give a person a clean slate. I've done my time. It's time to move on. I've qualified. Let me have this. And we're saying in Oregon, yes, to many different types of charges. But there's this one particular circumstance where a person who is on probation does so poorly, their probation is revoked by the judge. It doesn't seem fair, doesn't seem right to most people that a person whose probation is revoked can still seek expungement after 3 years. But that's what the Court of Appeals says now is the letter of the law. So this particular amendment, what it will do, will provide a prohibition for people whose probations are revoked. They will have to wait 10 years before they can seek a set-aside of that conviction. That will give them an incentive to do their community service, to do their drug treatment, to pay their fines and fees, to make the victim whole in their cases. And that's why we think it's right for you to say yes to the idea that people who have their probation revoked should wait 10 years. The next change to the statute involves this thing called the violation. When you commit a crime and you're convicted, you can wait 3 years. But if you have a subsequent conviction, you have to wait 10 years before you can seek an application to have it expunged. That includes not only new misdemeanors and felonies, but violations. So something as simple as perhaps the unlawful possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, which this month is currently a violation, that would hold you up from seeking an expungement of your particular crime for 10 years. So what we're saying in this amendment is you get one free bite at the apple. If you have one violation that you commit in those 10 years, it's not going to be held against you. You can still seek expungement of your conviction. Another thing that this particular statute will do is that it will allow people, I guess it's the last thing that it will allow. No?
Assault three. Yeah.
There are certain crimes that are committed that should never be expunged, frankly. Most of them are A felonies. In fact, all A felonies cannot be expunged. Certain B felonies can never be expunged as well. These usually involve heinous crimes or vulnerable victims. One we're asking you today to say can never be expunged is assault three, but only in a certain circumstance. It's a circumstance where the victim is 10 years or younger, and the defendant is 18 years or older. We currently prohibit people from having criminal mistreatment in the first degree when they've assaulted a child from having that conviction ever expunged. We think assault three under these conditions should also be included amongst those convictions that can never be set aside because, again, some people need to be protected, especially the most vulnerable in our community. That's all I have as far as my testimony. I thank you very much for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
Any questions? Mr. Church, I have a comment.
You may.
I just need to say, making it entirely understandable for people, it's a little hard when it has sentences like, notwithstanding subsection 5 of this section, the provisions of subsection 1A of this section do not apply. That's not necessarily totally clear. I understand it now because I've had my freshman law class here this term. It's generally nice pretty good chart. Reading.
Chair Barker, actually, there is one teeny little amendment fix. We had submitted something. We needed to change the language from a traffic violation to motor vehicle violation.
No, from motor vehicle violation to traffic.
To traffic. And did that get submitted, and is it back? Because if it's not back,
yes,
if it's not back, maybe we can clean up that one phrase.
And it would also, Stephen, you could make a simple chart out of this so people could take a look and just.
I see.
I mean, I would think that would be
a chart?
Like a sentencing chart. I mean, so somebody could come and look at it and say, I did this.
Okay.
I've been here.
Grid.
Are we waiting for paper? Oh, it is what? Oh, it's ready to go, is it?
Chair Barker, sorry about that. I didn't include in the staff measure summary because it was such a simple fix, but we do need to incorporate the A2 amendments. It substitutes the word motor vehicle for traffic to make it consistent with the way the statute was currently written. And so we would need to adopt the A2 amendments. I do need to make sure we have the fiscals in. I believe we do. But if we want to come back to that after we move on to other bills, we can do that as well.
Okay. We'll do that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They're not up on Olus, so it would be nice to check them.
And we'll at least temporarily close the – well, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 908A. Is President Courtney coming back? You take a peek at we'll go ahead and move on. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 385A.
And Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 385A comes to us from the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill adds justice court, municipal court, probate court, and juvenile court to the definition of court facility where firearms and other weapons are prohibited absent specific circumstances. It establishes that prohibited knives are also not allowed, and these include pocket knives. It authorizes municipal, probate, juvenile, and justice court judges to establish procedures regulating the possession of firearms and other weapons in court facilities. The bill establishes that in shared court facilities, the order, policy, or procedure of the presiding court judge takes precedence over that of a municipal court judge, probate court judge, juvenile court judge, or justice of the peace. The bill establishes that conviction under the section is a Class C felony and clarifies that a court may only prohibit weapons in the area where the court conducts business and during the hours the court operates.
Okay. Patrick Singh and Scott Winkles.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. We worked with the Municipal Judges Association and also the Justices of the Peace Association to create this bill during the interim. It stemmed from at least one known incident that I believe came out of Clackamas County Justice Court, where somebody who was upset about a traffic violation came into the courtroom after researching the law and figuring out that they could come into the courtroom with a firearm. No incident, of course, but obviously there's potential for weird things to happen when folks are mad. So the justices of the peace and the municipal court judges realized that in certain cases they do not fall under the definition of a local court facility or a court facility. So worked to get municipal and justice courts into the definition. And then we also realized we have about seven counties who still operate under old county court jurisdiction that sometimes have juvenile and probate cases that wanted to be included in this as well. So we addressed some of those amendments during the Senate hearings. We also worked with the Oregon Firearms Federation and the NRA to limit the scope of when a judge can ban weapons to, as counsel mentioned, the hours of court operation and areas where the court operates. So if you take a city hall, for instance, where the council chambers might be used as a municipal court, like in Kaiser, the judge there would have that ban only when the court operates, or let's say in an area where a clerk may work, but not for the entire building. So that would be an example of that limitation. So on behalf of our three organizations, we hope that you will pass the bill, pass the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, well, go ahead, Scott. What do you
For the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, appearing in support of this piece of legislation. Under current law, a presiding court, circuit court judge has the authority to prohibit weapons in their courtroom, and that was a that was added into the statute during, I believe, in the late 90s when Oregon was adopting its concealed weapons, change of the concealed weapon carry law. The it did not include municipal local courts. We believe that those is appropriate for the, those judges to be able to have the same authority. We have municipal courts in this state that operate robust criminal courts. People are being found guilty of crimes. They are being sentenced to incarceration. Their tempers can get out of hand. It's we simply believe as a matter of public safety that the we should have the local courts should have the same ability to prohibit weapons as do the circuit courts. With that, I'll eager for your questions.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I thought I heard this statement that this that pocket knives were excluded as a weapon. I think this says the opposite, right? Did I miss?
No, I thought I heard it included.
This says except a pocket knife with a blade less than 4 inches in length.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, that's correct. It does apply to pocket knives, and you've said it, stated it correctly, only if it's under 4 inches, over 4 inches in length. So it's specific to how large the knife is, whether it's prohibited.
I know in the circuit court in Portland, pocket knives are still excluded, but maybe this makes it clearer with the addition of the 4-inch thing.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, it has to do with whether or not that person would be guilty of a crime versus having that be prohibited as part of a local court rule. So under this bill, you would be guilty of a crime if you carried such a weapon with a blade over 4 inches
a blade.
In the facility.
The blade knife.
Yes, yes.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question, and Patrick, either one of you. Okay, so when I was reading into this, this seemed to have stemmed from the incident in Clackamas County, if I remember right. And so I read as much as I could about that, and then I did some study of the last, well, I went back to 1913, I think, trying to find another case of, outside of the Old West days of 1885, somebody brandishing a firearm in a courtroom. So we're talking about a concealed weapon, right, of which nobody would know unless what? How did they find out that this fellow in Clackamas County was packing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, I don't know all the specifics about the Clackamas situation. I don't know if he was open carrying or not. Certainly, we have a number of counties and some cities that are facing fiscal distress, and so oftentimes the security isn't there to screen everybody like there is in a lot of different circuit courts. But certainly, again, this is another tool that we hope our local communities can choose to implement if they would like. As far as enforcement, that's a very good question of whether or not, you know, I don't think everybody's going to start getting frisked when they go into court or anything like that. But I'm sure our courts will probably post signs if they chose to implement the law.
Follow. I guess that's my point. So we're going to have to go to some sort of enforcement. This bill's worthless if it doesn't have enforcement, because right now a judge can say, stand on your head and whistle Dixie. The judge can say anything. He can ban anything. He, she can ban anything. It's already part of our law. And so we're really kind of, to me, addressing a problem that doesn't exist, because there was a situation in Clackamas and nobody would have known the man was carrying a firearm unless there was a pat down or a metal detector or something that he got through. And I read the story in the case and I didn't see anything. He bragged that he had one, is what I understand. We don't even know that he had one. So that's my fear from this. This is another situation where I don't know what the problem is.
Clackamas County does have a metal detector.
Okay. So you go.
Because they wouldn't let me in.
Already.
They wouldn't
let
me in the courtroom with a small knife.
Right, so there
not in the Justice Court.
Oh, not in Justice Court. Okay.
Okay. But, so there would still have to be enforcement. Either way, there would have to be enforcement. How do you know? Yeah. So just by putting a sign up saying, hey, you can't have a weapon, it's a concealed handgun license.
I did talk to one justice of the peace who said and he'd had people come into his courtroom with open carry, which he found to be intimidating to somebody else. So. Yep.
And that would be absolutely different. I could see something in here that would say, that addresses that.
Well, this says you can't have a gun in the courtroom, so.
You have to start patting people down.
Further questions or not?
Comment, if I may, Chair Barker. I'm aware of a second case also in Clackamas County. You know, Clackamas County is how we roll. The one that came up was in the Justice Court in Clackamas County, and I thought, although I could be wrong, that it was an open carry situation. I could be wrong. The other one I recall was back in 2009. I used to represent the city of Damascus. A very unpleasant experience. I don't recommend it to anyone. And there was an open carry situation in the Damascus Municipal Court, I recall, which I don't even think exists anymore. But I do recall it being a situation now.
But again, the judge have just said, I'm sorry, no, you can't have that here.
But I think
it's already law.
The Municipal Court in Damascus, I believe it is.
The judge has the ability to say that in any court, anywhere, at any time.
I don't believe that's accurate in Municipal Court anymore.
Chair Barker.
That's what this board would do.
That Chair Barker, Representative Post, and Representative Barton, that is correct. Under the current law, no, that judge would not have the authority to do that. However, Senate Bill 385 would allow the judge to do that. And that's what this bill does.
Right now, judges do not have the ability
to. In municipal,
in any court.
No, in circuit court, you can't go in. In the circuit court, you can't. But in municipal or justice courts, they can't prohibit you from.
So, Chair Barker and Representative Post, the current bill, ORS 166-360, as is written right now, prohibits somebody from carrying such a firearm in a circuit court, a court of appeals, the Supreme Court, or the Oregon Tax Court. So in any of those instances, yes, a judge would be able to prohibit it, and in fact, it would be a violation of the criminal code. However, this bill allows a municipal court judge, a justice of the peace court judge, a juvenile court judge, to have that same protection, to make it a violation of the criminal code for somebody to do that. So there is a difference between whether or not this is going to be a crime and whether or not it's a local court rule. For example, Representative Greenlake mentioned that Multnomah County doesn't allow pocket knives of any sort, but whether or not it would be a crime to carry that in there is another matter altogether.
Okay.
Chair, yes. If I may, Chair Barker, sure. Members of the committee, if I heard your counsel correctly, I must disagree slightly. I believe there is another prohibition in the statute that would prohibit a local government from prohibiting concealed carry in any public building in another statute. So we have the same restriction the state does, whereas the state can't prohibit CWP carry in its public buildings, neither can we. The only exception is in a circuit court, and we're simply asking for the same authority that the circuit court judges have.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Sterrett, please.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Sterrett with Oregon Firearms Federation. Unfortunately, I think you've made a mistake here. We litigated this very issue, and Representative Post is exactly right. The judges have the authority to ban guns in municipal and justice courts. And this is not speculation on my part. The lawsuit in case was in Damascus, of all places, Jim Leuenberger versus Damascus. We took it to the circuit court, and the circuit court said, yes, municipal courts and justice courts are not specifically labeled in the statute as the courts that are included in this. But a judge is still a judge. And he can make whatever rule he wants and hold you in contempt if you don't obey it. I personally interacted with this in the Canby court myself when my wife was subpoenaed to testify against some gang members. I knew that the court didn't have a blanket prohibition, but the judge had a prohibition. I asked the judge if he would allow me to protect my wife in the courtroom. He said no. That resulted in the following lawsuit. As it turns out, that these same people who my wife was due to testify against next appearance in court fought with each other and the police, so I don't think my concerns were unjustified. But the fact is that the judges are judges. And while some good changes were made from the original statute. This bill is entirely unnecessary, and all of this could have been settled with an email to the judges who apparently don't know what their powers are. And it's a little concerning to me that we would have all these judges come and testify who didn't know that this was the case. And that is, as I said, this has already been litigated. We brought that up on the Senate side. They did make some changes so that the rooms in question wouldn't be off limits all the time. They recently moved the municipal court in my town from this chambers where the city hall was to a room in the police station. My police station currently has a sign posted saying no firearms, which they have no authority to do, which the chief told me he had no authority to do and didn't take it down. But on page 2 of the bill, where it describes what a local court facility is, it says a building or in which a justice court, municipal court, probate court, court conducts business. And you can't get into the municipal court in the Canby police station without walking through the hallways you would need to talk to anybody else in there. And I wonder if they would consider that a place where they conduct business. But the fact is that they have that power now. And if you want to look it up, you know, as I said, it's been adjudicated and it's in the law.
So if they could already do this,
yes.
What would the bill hurt to pass? I mean, what if we pass this bill?
I think that's a great question. I think one of the problems, one of my concerns, of course, is the ambiguity in that language. But I suppose that we can take that position any time. And there's half a dozen bills that have gone through the Senate Judiciary Committee, going through here, that I think have accomplished absolutely nothing because they were already existing law. So they didn't hurt, but I have no idea why we spend so much time on things that are already law because people are ignorant of them. So, no, this is not going to hurt, but I don't see where it was worth all our time on this.
Maybe it would clarify. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 385A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 385A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 385A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenlick?
Aye.
Representative Cranier?
Excused.
Representative Leinecker?
Aye.
Representative Post?
Nay.
Representative Springer?
Excused.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier? Somebody can carry the bill. Representative Olson?
No, take it.
Okay. Representative Olson, thank you. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 3A. Call President Courtney, please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 3A comes to us from President Courtney. The bill creates the crime of endangering a person protected by a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order. It establishes that if a person is previously convicted of a violating an order at the time of a second offense, violation of a restraining order constitutes a Class A misdemeanor. It provides that an offender places a protected party at a substantial risk of serious physical injury while violating a restraining order at any time. The violation constitutes a Class C felony. We do have proposed -A6 amendments before us today, which take the bill back to the measure as introduced. The measure as introduced only deals with the substantial risk of serious physical injury while violating the restraining order, constituting a Class C felony, and removes the portions concerning stacking of offenses.
Please.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, and members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Peter Courtney, and I live here in Salem. I'm a state senator from District 11. I'm here today to testify in support of what is indicated as Senate Bill 3, a bill that came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and came off the Senate floor. This measure increases the punishment for breaking a family abuse prevention restraining order. There had been much work done behind the scenes on this bill. Amendments have gone back and forth, and many people here, including your counsel, can speak to the specifics. I'm basically going to speak to what I think is the need. On July 21, 2014, Cassandra Wagner, filed a restraining order against her ex-boyfriend, Jason Down. 40 days later, she was dead. On August 4th, Down violated that restraining order and was sentenced to 90 days, misdemeanor. He'd only been in jail a few days, but on August 17th, after only 3 days in jail, Down was shifted to work release center. And on August 30th, 2014, according to the police, he shot and killed Cassandra Wagner. Cassandra Wagner's murderer had two other restraining orders against him, both for threats of serious violence from his sister and his former wife. He had been convicted of assault twice and armed burglary once. At the time of the first restraining order violation, he was on probation for a misdemeanor assault against his adult son. In fact, the 90-day jail sentence was not even in response to the restraining order, but rather the probation he violated. When Down violated that restraining order on August 4th, he should have been gotten more than just a 90-day sentence in jail. At least that was what drove me, among many other cases that researched, to introduce this bill. He should have received more than the 6 months, which is the current maximum for restraining order violation. That is, the current maximum for restraining order violation is 6 months. The judge should have had the option of recognizing his danger to society, to his victim, and been able to sentence him to a felony conviction. This bill, in effect, creates, for the first time, violation of restraining orders in the state of Oregon, a Class C felony. We are facing a domestic violence death more than twice a month. More than twice a month, people are dying from domestic violence in the state of Oregon. That is not a made-up figure. Many of these cases involve active restraining orders. Last year, 557 people applied for restraining orders in my county, this county, Marin County. There were 361 violations. When there is clear threat of injury in these cases, judges need an additional avenue, an additional judicial weapon. We need to treat restraining order violations as the serious crimes they are. This bill is about changing domestic violence victims into domestic violence survivors. This is a first step in changing the outcome for women like Cassandra Wagner. So I would hope that you would carefully evaluate this bill, research it, and I would hope that individually and collectively, and I refer to your wisdom, you can find a way to perhaps think this is good public policy and to move it on. But whatever, I am very pleased you were willing to at least consider this piece of legislation. I say that because, not to be tongue-in-cheek, but my biggest bill this session, the major crime bill I worked on for 4 years, never even got a public hearing in the House, the Senate. So I'm sort of down about that. So at least you've been good enough to at least hear this bill. It is a serious effort to do something about violating restraining order in the area of domestic violence, because it is a serious problem, and we're simply trying to create an alternative so a judge can say, all right, the judge knows that he can sentence this person to up to five years and, I believe, $235,000 in a fine. So these individuals, perhaps, if they're in jail, they cannot do this kind of violence. Hopefully then that the whatever is driving them, the blind rage, the revenge, the insane jealousy, whatever, can be calmed by that time so that they will not act out in the manner that many of them do. So thank you for allowing me to come here today and testify on this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for President Courtney? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are testifying in favor of the A6 amendment, and the effect of the A6 amendment is it reverts the bill back to the original version as originally introduced by Senator Courtney over on the Senate side. So the reason we support the A6, is very streamlined, it's very targeted, it's simple, and it directs itself, it focuses on the dangerous, threatening conduct that can put a person in grave jeopardy. So what the A6 would do, consistent with the original introduced bill, is it says that if you were served with a FAPA order and you intentionally engage in conduct that's prohibited by that order, and then by so engaging in that conduct, you recklessly create a substantial risk of physical injury to the person protected by the order, or you intentionally place that person in fear of imminent physical injury, in that instance, that is a C felony. And at the time that Senator Courtney introduced his original bill, OCDLA was neutral on it. We did not engage, and we had no objection to that at all. What happened was a little confusing from our end. We weren't aware of other discussions going on that resulted in the A engrossed version, and those were voted into the bill in the last work session there. And our problems with the A engrossed version is that it goes way beyond all that. It tiers things, and so it acknowledges that there are some violations of FAPA that are not as egregious or serious as that which is addressed in the A6 amendment. And for those, it allows those initially to be punished as violations for contempt under a violation of a restraining order. But then should those should further repeat contact occur, it's pretty easily, the way the bill is written, the engrossed version, you, by the guideline calculations, you can get up to a C felony pretty quickly, and then given prior criminal histories based on, again, those very same contacts, you would get into presumptive prison land pretty quickly. And so we think, we're not even convinced from what we've been told that the A engrossed really reflects the intentions of those that sought the amendment, but again, we weren't party to those conversations. We would support going back to the original introduced version, which before you is the A6. Again, we think it's very streamlined, it's targeted, it's focused, it's direct, and it's simple.
Thank you. President Courtney, I gather that you're sitting side by side, and the A6 is okay, is your original version. You're okay with the A6 amendment? Is that, are you cool either way? Or?
Door number 6.
Chair Barker, Your Honor, Representative Barton, I'm sitting side by side because I don't want to be here alone. I don't like to sit at these foot. I don't like to be alone. I got to be very. I should have left now. I really wish I had. I'm going to be very careful here. We thought we'd introduced a masterpiece on the Senate side, and I say that because I want to give Honor Braun. You don't know Honor Braun, but she's worked some office. She has worked for years. Well, let me just finish, Representative Braun. Would you please learn? You learn to allow a person to finish, and then you can say what you're going to say. So, and then there's a Jessica Menifee, you probably don't, legislative counsel, and they have more than once made my life miserable because they don't let me introduce what I want to introduce. They say, you're not only on the Constitution, it's not going to work. And so they always have their way. So the bill was really, I thought, beautifully put together, as you have, that is, but you didn't say it was beautiful. But so I introduced it, and I got my heart broken because I ran into the thing called the rocket docket in Multnomah County. I have no idea what the rocket docket is. I've never even heard of it, but there's a rocket docket in Multnomah County. I heard of district attorneys. With all due respect, that they had the defense attorneys in the Oregon Law Institute. And, you know, they sort of took exception to the masterpiece. So it got made to what it is here in front of you. Do you understand? On my way over here, a birdie came to me. There's actually a birdie in the hall, and said, Peter, there's some amendments that takes the bill back to the original version. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I said, this cannot be. My life has not been good because I thought maybe I'd introduced a bad bill. So I don't know what to say. You know, I thought the original bill was a good bill. Until you listen to all the people who's trying to slaughter me, you can't do this. It's terrible. You're going to destroy this. It's not fair. We got to have these two passed. I mean, I'm being very honest with you, Representative Brown. So I don't know what to tell you. I think we need to do something. We need to get to a felony C felony for violating restraining orders and make sure the judges, when they got somebody in front of them who's dangerous, can say, you know what, you're going to jail for a longer period of time. That's where I am. I'm not trying to mess with you, but I got to be very careful because, you see, the bill's got to come back to the Senate. Do you understand what I mean? If you amend it, and I'm sort of sending you a signal, you're not going to get me in any more trouble than you already got me with a certain person who lives here in the morning. Do you understand what I just said to you? Well, let somebody else explain it to you.
I don't know.
This is another committee meets here in the morning.
I'll explain it. Any further questions?
Did you call this the lower chamber?
I never called you the lower chamber with all due. I don't like that. I've never referred to the House as the lower chamber. Never will do that.
The recording.
Don't do it.
Chair Barker, I just want to throw out there, if anybody has a question about that Rocket Docket thing, I can answer it. But I honestly don't think it's reflected in the A engrossed. I don't think it reads the way it's supposed to.
Somebody was in error.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, that is correct. This actually creates a new crime called endangering a person protected by a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order. The so-called Rocket Docket has to do with a regular restraining order violation where somebody violates a no-contact order that a judge has imposed. This would create a new crime and would give the district attorney the ability to charge that crime if certain additional elements are met, including placing somebody at a substantial risk of physical injury by violating the order. So it's actually a different crime than your traditional violation of restraining order.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Campbell, did you want to testify on this one?
Thank you. I'm surprised, but thank you.
10 quick seconds.
Okay.
It always is.
Thank you, Mr. Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I agree with whatever the Senate President wants. Thank you for your time. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very quickly, we do support Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and we do support Senate Bill 3. We can accept the amendment. I think our folks are deeply concerned. Some of the stories that Senate President Courtney shared are repeated in a lot of places around the state. It says something about a person who will willingly violate a batterer who will willingly violate their restraining order. And in many of these cases, it's one of the more dangerous events for both the victim and actually police officers that they encounter. And so we believe that a tool that addresses or better addresses a repeat violation of restraining orders is perfectly well suited to your work and would be helpful to us. There may be interest in doing more in the future to address this, but I will say that we do support both the impetus behind and the work that's being done to accomplish Senate Bill 3, and for that reason, we are supportive of the bill and can accept the amendment. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Questions for Mr. Chair?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a comment and a question. So hopefully there's no other parts of the state that would do the same thing that Cottage Grove would do when I was down there out of that office. But there were a few families up Raw River Road that would have restraining orders. The girlfriend would invite the boyfriend back overnight for a love session and then call 911 and state police to come and arrest him the next morning. So how does this apply?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, is that the definition of a loaded question or what?
Just a thought.
It's an excellent thought for which I have no real response.
Council, please.
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, it wouldn't apply in this case unless there was some substantial risk of physical injury as part of the session. Yes, if the
A6 were to be
adopted.
Thank you. Okay, got it.
It doesn't involve swatting.
Yeah, right. If I might, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, that is the difference between the A engrossed and the dash A6. That's why we're asking for the A6 to move.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing, open a work session on.
We're waiting on the paperwork.
Okay.
Unless you want to move the A6 in.
We go.
Do it. I think we need to have the paperwork.
We'll just close the public hearing on this. We don't have the paperwork ready to go.
open a public hearing on Senate Bill 397A.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 397A comes to us from the Senate Interim Committee and is the product of a Senate work group on ignition interlock devices. This bill establishes that when a defendant participating in a driving under the influence of intoxicants diversion, when defendant is participating in driving under the influence of intoxicants diversion, the provider who installed the ignition interlock device must notify the court or the court's designee and the district attorney or city prosecutor of a negative report within 7 business days. The bill defines negative report and allows the Department of Transportation to further define test violations by rule. It requires that negative report notification be in a format prescribed by the Department of Transportation and provides that people may not have an ignition interlock device removed unless they demonstrate 90 days without a negative report. The bill allows a person participating in a diversion to petition the court for removal of an ignition interlock device after 6 consecutive months without a negative report. It provides that a court or agency may not charge a defendant an additional fee to pay the cost incurred by the agency or organization in carrying out their duties. The bill allows a department to remove ignition interlock device requirements from a person's driving record as soon as practicable after receiving a certificate memorializing 90 days without a negative report. We do have some proposed Dash A4 amendments before us today. However, I've been informed by the person that introduced those amendments that there may be a drafting error. The intention of the A4 was to remove the portions that state that a court or agency may not charge an additional fee to pay cost incurred by an agency or organization in carrying out their duties. However, the amendments ended up removing more of the bill than was originally intended. So there will be an additional amendment coming that takes that out.
Okay. Senator Thatcher, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kim Thatcher, State Senator, District 13. And a little update on the Dash A4. Right before I came down here, I was told that the amendment is actually good to go. We were afraid that it took out the current language. But rest assured, all it did was it's no longer in the amendment addressing that since there are no changes in that amendment or to that statute anymore. So it's just not being addressed in the amendment at all. So that's why. So I think the Dash A4s are good to go. But I'm in basic support of the concept, but it came to my attention that limiting the fee at $150 is problematic for some of the ADIS programs out there that might be negatively affected, and we should look at this situation during the interim and figure out it's kind of a broader issue when it comes to the ADIS programs. But for now, let's leave it alone and deal with it during the interim.
Okay, so this amendment will restore the ADIS money that was taken out. When they set aside, they eliminated that. So this will put it back to where it was before.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's what it would do. It would just restore it before we did the amendments on the Senate side.
And then we'd like to look during the interim to see about increasing those.
Or what to do with the ADIS program in general, yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for the senator? Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Bob Thummel, I'm sorry, I know I'm saying that wrong, but okay. And okay, we'll let you go first. And Amy Joyce, you could come up.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Bob Thummel. I am a criminal defense lawyer who's practiced in Portland for the last 38 years, and a large part of my practice involves defending people who are charged with driving under the influence of intoxicants. Many of them in diversion programs, and others face consequences if they're convicted following a trial, so this bill speaks to them. My friend Gail asked me to come down and talk about this bill today, and I would say that my short take on it is that it is something for everybody here. I think it provides 2 or 3 good protections for a person charged or who's dealing with an ignition interlock device. Section 1 or Section 2 has the short timelines to get the negative report identified and get it up and have a court dealing with it. I can tell you stories about people who have sat in jail for up to 2 weeks in Tillamook County or other counties where a negative report came along and it was a matter of getting the report and getting it to the prosecutor, and it could be a false report. There was one where there was a high BAC of a 0.21. 2 minutes later, the person blew again, and it was a 0.02. And 2 minutes after that, it was a 0.00. So it was really a clear case of mouthwash, and finally coaxing the letter out of the ignition interlock people and getting it to the attention of the prosecutor took 2 weeks, where we'd all agree it was a false positive, but the person sat in jail. So this bill provides a lot of protection for that sort of thing. It provides a get tough provision where it says, hey, you've got to be clean for 90 days before we let you off the IID. And my response to that is good. I have no problem with that. And if people want to get off the ignition interlock device, I think having to walk that for 90 days without a negative report is a fine thing. It also provides a 6-month possibility of early termination, which is also good for somebody who gets it and is providing clean blows all along the way. So that's a good part, too. And finally, I think there's a third benefit, which is in sections. There are two sections in the back that talk about hidden fees. Section 5, where a court or an agency may not charge a person additional fees, essentially to pay costs incurred by the agency or organization in carrying out the duties of the agency. On behalf of people who are dealing with those agencies, I think initial fees are one thing, but little fees along the way, they can become just a nickel dime situation where it becomes unworkable for them financially. So on behalf of my clientele, I see a lot of things in this bill that are positive and represent sort of a house cleaning effort to get the ignition interlock program more in track for everybody's well-being. And that's what I had to say, unless anyone has any questions for me.
So you probably just heard what we're talking about doing is there was a part taken out for some of the ADIS fees were taken out, but we're looking at restoring those. That.
And as I understand, I'm going to let Gail speak to that. I think she's more on the fee track than I am, but go ahead.
Chair Parker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the issue of fees being charged for ADISs is a pretty complicated conversation, and it's been going on for a long time. So the effect of the amendment is to restore the fees that were in the original bill on the other side, which elevated the fee from $150 to $275. Is that right? No?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, that is not correct. The amendments would take it back to the status quo, so it wouldn't include that increase. It would just be the $150.
Okay. And those current fees, if I might ask for a clarifying question, those current fees are statutorily based and those were removed?
So currently, Chair Barker and members of the committee, 813.021 sub B says pay directly to the agency or organization conducting the screening interview a fee
right.
of $150.
Right.
The bill as introduced before it was worked by the work group increased that to $275. That's not part of this. The amendment would maintain the current statutory language, which sets that at $150.
And Chair Barker, I don't see that being altered by the bill. Is it altered by the bill?
There is a section that states a court or agency may not charge an additional fee to pay the costs incurred by the agency or organization in carrying out their duties. So basically, what it does is maintain the status quo with regards to ADIS fees, as I understand the intention.
Chair Barker, I can speak to that. Now I understand what's going on. There's two different kinds of fees that were being imposed by some courts with respect to the ADISes. The statutory fee that is currently on page 6 of the bill, line 17, as I understand it, is remaining flat, $150. Okay. The other language that's imposed that's new in the bill, the subsection 5 on line 34, mm-hmm. and then on page 7, line 4, it reads, a court or an agency may not charge a defendant an additional fee to pay the costs for carrying out the duties of the agency or the organization. This is what's been happening. In some jurisdictions, the court was saying to the ADIS, you shall be responsible for monitoring the negative reports that come out of this IID. And those negative reports would often be nothing but computer printouts, and they would, you know, accordion file down to the floor. And so someone needed to review them because they were in a format that nobody else, a layperson, couldn't read them or understand them. And so the courts were, some courts in some counties were saying to the ADIS, I'm ordering you, you're going to be monitoring these negative reports. And because this is additional obligations and burdens on you, I'm going to order the defendant to pay you an additional monitoring fee. Now, the monitoring fee was not authorized by legislation. So this is over and above the 150 that you see codified in 1813.021. And so there had been, in those counties where that unauthorized monitoring fee was ordered to be paid by the defendant, there were attempts made in some cases where the defense attorney would come forward and say, this isn't authorized by legislation, and why should my client have to pay this additional fee? And so the courts would say, and so the ADIS would say, well, until you pay this, I'm not processing your evaluation, and if I don't process your evaluation, then you're not going to be able to finish your diversion. There was some legislators submitted to Ledge Council a request for a formal opinion as to whether or not the courts had the authority to order those monitoring fees when they had not been authorized by legislation. I was allowed to see that opinion, and that opinion said it was nuanced, but basically the argument that the judiciary was relying upon was not affirmed by Ledge Council. So what I understand, this new language in subsection 5 and in on page 7 as well, that doesn't address the statutory fee to the ADIS. That prohibits a court from, in addition to that, ordering the defendant to pay the ADIS a monitoring fee for the purpose of monitoring the negative report. What the bill also accomplishes is, in Section 2, it specifies whose job it is to look at the negative report. It says to the provider of the ignition interlock device, you shall put this data on a form that ODOT prescribes that is readable to the layperson so someone can know what this negative report is, and then you shall send this to the court and the district attorney. So it untriangulates the issue, removes the ADIS out of it. The bill says the negative reports goes from the installer of the ignition interlock device to the court and the DA on a form that's to be prescribed to it. And courts, you may not order the defendant to pay the ADIS an additional fee that it's not been authorized by this legislative body over and above the statutory fee.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I need to leave early. Can I ask the counsel a question, please? Yes. I was trying to figure out the 6-month versus 12-month. Is it the effect of this bill that it reduces the time period that's required for a person to have an interlock device under some circumstances from 12 months to 6 months?
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlake, the bill allows somebody in a diversion to petition the court for a removal of the device after 6 consecutive months. Whether or not the court decides to do that will be up to the judge in evaluating the case. For example, some car crashes are very, very bad, and a court may decide your BAC was so high and the accident was so bad, I'm not removing the ignition interlock device even if you go 6 months. Others may be in a different case, and the judge evaluating that case decides to exercise their discretion in removing it. So the idea was, while we also have a portion that says you may not remove the ignition interlock device if you can't demonstrate 90 days clean, there's sort of a carrot and a stick approach. If you can get 6 months, you may ask the court for it to be removed, but you can't, for example, have a negative report the day before you're supposed to have it removed and then have it removed the next day. You have to then demonstrate 90 days clean before you can
do so. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Just very quickly, on the Senate side, we were able to work with Chair Brzezinski and Senator Thatcher on some modifications to the bill, frankly, just to get the fiscal down. And the main thing I just want to kind of point out and put on the record is that when these folks demonstrate they're 90 days clean so they can have that ignition interlock removed. It changes the way DMV processes the record. It goes from a hard-coded date to kind of an open-ended date and makes it a much more manual process. And so that's why you see the language where it can show up on somebody's record as soon as practicable for DMV, because with our ancient computer system, it's an overnight batch process. When you walk out of DMV, your record is not going to show you no longer need the ignition interlock. It's going to show up the next day, probably turn into a fix-it ticket in court if someone were pulled over that same day for failure to have an ignition interlock. So really just wanted to put that on the record that that's why that's in there and what the reality will be for folks who exercise this benefit. As to the discussion about the ADIS fee, we didn't have any involvement in that, don't have really any dog in that fight. So I'm open to any questions anyone may have.
Anybody have any questions for Ms. Joyce? Thank you very much, Patty. Appreciate it. Teresa Douglas, Sally Pena, and Margaret Gorsiak. And obviously we can't, we have people had to leave, so we're not going to have enough people to actually pass the bill today. And also we're waiting for the amendment which would restore the ADIS, which we plan to do. That's our intention.
Okay.
My intention. I have enough votes. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Teresa Douglas. I'm the director of Pioneer Alcohol and Drug Evaluation Services in Oregon City. I've been providing the evaluation services for the courts in Clackamas County for the last 30-plus years. I want to speak to you today about Senate Bill 397. One thing I wanted to make clear is that this bill has some good parts to it and has some really negative parts to it. I'm for defining what a negative IID report is. That is really an issue for me right now. I'm getting negative reports from the interlock companies, and then they're coming back and saying, no, it really wasn't a violation. And so we need some clarification on that. I cannot see where the evaluator is going to be taken out of the monitoring of the interlock device. There is so much paperwork that's coming in and so much work that's being done on these that the courts do not have the personnel to handle that. So I believe the evaluators will still be heavily involved in the monitoring of the interlock device. I want to point out that the $150 fee was passed 11 years ago. Most of us are private business owners now. There's very few of us that are associated with the county. We employ people, we have overhead, and the cost of business continues to rise. The courts have recognized that we do a lot of work for them. I not only monitor their treatment, I monitor their interlock device, I make sure they go to their victim panel, I notify the court when there's violations. There is a lot of work that is being done on these cases. And my courts recognize that, and they have allowed me to charge extra fees. Keep in mind that some of these fees are not imposed if the work doesn't need to be done. So if someone comes to me and they get a referral, and they fail out of the treatment program and they need to be re-referred to another program, they pay me a fee for that. It's extra work. We also have no-show fees because, surprise, surprise, people don't show up for their appointments. And so this fee has really motivated people to show up for their appointments and get themselves into treatment and get their programs going. And so that's been a huge thing for us. In addition, I have another evaluator that works for me, and she gets paid by appointment. So I have to pay her for that appointment, whether someone shows up for it or not. The other thing is that we are kind of a check and balance in the system, in that, you know, there's times when we have to work with the treatment program, there's times we have to work with the client. The clients come in to me all the time saying they don't understand anything about what they're supposed to be doing. No one's explained anything to them. By the time they leave my office, they understand what is going to be required and what they need to be doing. And they come in and they're so frustrated because there's so many different pieces to the system. The other thing is that, you know, we get people that we refer to treatment, and unfortunately some of the treatment providers are not really up to snuff on the levels of care they should be giving to people. I just had one last week. I had a client that blew a .23, and I sent him to a program in another part of the state, and they put him in an information-only program, which is a very minimal treatment program, very minimal urine testing program. So I had to intervene and say, this person needs treatment. And that's the evaluator's piece, is we are there to work with the court, with the client, with the public, and ensure that things are done properly. I will speak to the six months interlock removal. I will tell you from experience that the first 6 months, people are in treatment, they're being urine tested, they're being monitored. It is that last 6 months when they're out of treatment, when they need the interlock device. That is when people relapse. I can't tell you how many people have finished their treatment and I've caught them drinking with the interlock device. If that's removed, there is no way for us to know that they are drinking, and you're going to see an increase in recidivism, and it's going to reduce public safety. So I would really ask you to vote no on this bill. I would support the -4 amendments as well if need be, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
My name is Margaret Gorsiak, and I am the Director of Evaluation Services in Washington County, and I, too, have been involved in the business for over 30-plus years. So I think you're dealing with some people who have had a great deal of experience and opportunities in dealing with this population for a very long period of time. At the risk of repeating some of the concerns already noted, I would like to explain that our role is so much more than just doing an evaluation and referring out to treatment and sending a violation report to the court. It really is a very comprehensive process and procedure, beginning first with meeting with the defendant, reviewing all the rules and regulations of the program, trying to address their issues of concern, and trying to help them be successful in working through the process and procedure of diversion and probation. And also we work with treatment providers. So if a client is not non-compliant, does not do what they are required to do, it requires a great deal of time and effort. We don't automatically send them back to court and say, hey, this person isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing. We initiate contact with them by we try a call, we try letters, emails, et cetera, and we try and work with the defendant in understanding what are the blocks to their being successful in the diversion program or on probation. And then we try and help them come to a reasonable resolution to that. The court has come to rely on our agency for recommendations on violation reports. So I make court appearances every single week, and if our fees are reduced, I'm not going to have the time to do that, and I simply can't afford to provide that service any longer. And that will then, I'm sure, fall on the treatment agencies to make their court appearances to explain to the court what is happening, and the treatment agency in turn will then have to pass that fee on to the defendant. So I'm not sure eliminating some of these fees is really going to be as successful as maybe is initially thought would be. I also work a great deal with probation officers. So if I'm supervising somebody who's also on probation for another case, I deal with a probation officer. So we're working together. So not one agency isn't telling them to do one thing and another agency is telling them to do another. It's very time consuming. If there's medication prescribed, I have to get a release of information signed so I can communicate with the prescribing physician so that I can make sure that the person is taking medications as properly prescribed, et cetera. Again, this is all very time consuming. If the Department of Human Health and Human Services is involved, Child Protective Services, I work with a caseworker. So again, we're all working together. It's very involved, very time consuming. It's not an easy process. The screening assessment fee has not been increased for 10 years plus, but the cost of my business has continued to increase. So as noted by Teresa Douglas, when there was a no-show fee that I was allowed to begin charging no-show fees, my no-show rate decreased quite considerably because the person understood it wasn't that they just couldn't no-show. They had to pay a fee for that no-show. And so that has helped my agency to become more financially stable, but also use our time more efficiently when they're because clients keep their appointments. The extension fee requires six more. When a person is granted an extension in diversion, they are given six more months to complete the requirements of the diversion program. That requires six more months of monitoring by my agency. So it seems only reasonable and fair that there should be some reimbursement for those services. I would also like to address my concerns regarding the proposed changes to the section of the bill related to the ignition interlock device. Although diversion is considered a first arrest for driving under the influence of intoxicants in a 15-year period of time, it doesn't necessarily indicate that it is truly the first time that person is driven under the influence of intoxicants. In fact, many times in my evaluations, clients will readily admit this is the time that they got caught, that they've done this before. The statistics indicate the offense of driving under the influence of intoxicants has a very significant detrimental impact on society, and I think it's important that we focus on what we already know to be a serious offense rather than lighten the restrictions on those who've been charged with that offense. If the person is allowed to have the ignition interlock device removed after the first 6 months, I believe that will have a very negative impact on society. As Teresa Douglas had indicated, many of these clients go through the first 3, 4, 5, 6 months, and they can comply. They can do exactly everything they need to do. And once out of treatment, and they know they're not going to be doing urinalysis testing, and they're not going to be monitored on a weekly basis by being in treatment groups, they resume use of alcohol. And I have seen numerous violations on the ignition interlock device. And it frequently occurs within the first month after they have completed their treatment program. And it is not uncommon for them to go through their entire year of diversion and in their 11th month suddenly submit this failure with a breath alcohol content that can be quite significant. So I think that, you know, we need to remember that they got themselves into the system by operating a motor vehicle under the influence of intoxicants. And that to give them an extra benefit of being able to remove that IID after 6 months would be, making the offense more lenient for them. So I think it's really important that we require that they keep the ignition interlock device installed in their vehicle for the full year of their diversion program. So in summary, I respectfully request that you give this bill careful consideration before allowing it to advance. The clear negative consequences will have a very detrimental ripple effect on all components of the DUI system. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Please. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Sally Panna, and I'm an ADIS in Polk County. I've been working in the DUI system as an ADIS for 34 years. I speak here in strong opposition to the Senate Bill 397, but I'm going to confine my testimony to the sections 9, 10, and 11 for the sake of time. I support the amendment that Senator Thatcher brought forth, and I hope that those amendments are passed. I do not support her position that the fees should be addressed in an interim session. This bill came to you out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. A public hearing was held on the bill on February 18th. The bill originally was a fee increase for us, went through a gut and stuff process overnight, and it became an ignition interlock bill. But unbeknownst to many people, the bill also became a vehicle to undermine the ADIS position in Oregon. The amended bill passed through the committee without a public hearing on the new bill. What is essentially a new bill, and today is the first opportunity for public testimony. This amended bill gives the ADIS no raise in their fee and prohibits the courts from charging additional fees. Those two provisions I'm in strong disagreement with. The ADIS position originally was very well thought out. It is a very cost-effective position. It costs the general fund and the taxpayer nothing. The entire cost of the ADIS fees are borne by the defendant. The system is very well regulated. We're regulated both by the court and Oregon Health Authority, who oversee us. The position is supported by the courts. The ADIS has contributed to the Oregon recidivism rates being among the lowest in the country for many years. We've proven our role and our effectiveness in 34 years. And we are a necessary component of the system. Somebody has to do the work that we do. So what's not to like? I struggle with trying to figure out why the Senate Judiciary Committee passed this bill and why the Senate passed it on the floor. And I've struggled in that exploration. I have looked at the reason, and I come to the conclusion that the senators, for the most part, voted on this bill not knowing what was in the bill. That's why I've given you four different documents to exemplify the problem with this process. The first document is a copy of the bill itself, and the summary of the bill refers to it as modifying the laws regarding the interlock devices. Nowhere does it say the ADIS fees are going to be kept at the same level and judges are going to be restricted from raising those fees. There is no indication of that. You have to go all the way to the far end of this bill to get any indication of what it's going to impact on the ADIS. It says a court or an agency may not charge a person for an additional fee or cost, but it's buried in this bill. Most senators never got to that point. The other two clauses, again, are buried, the last two clauses. I think that's one of the primary reasons. The other document was the summary, which Mr. Rhodes read earlier. If you listen carefully to that summary, it was very difficult to discern from that reading that this bill impacts on the ADIS. In the first paragraph that Mr. Rhodes read, it said that it provides that this bill provides that court or agency may not charge the defendant additional fee to pay the cost incurred by the agency or organization in carrying out their duties. This is stuck in the middle of a paragraph dealing with IID devices. Unless you dig, you're not even going to see that sentence, and unless you're very sharp and know what's been going on with this bill, you're not going to know that it applies to the ADIS. The only other time that it is also included is in another paragraph dealing with the IID device, the last sentence. There is no paragraph in this summary that specifically draws people's attention to the fact that this bill has an amazing impact on the ADIS position. The next document that I've given you is just a copy of what is on the internet in terms of the catch line that most representatives are going to look to see what is in this bill. The catch line says that the bill modifies the laws regarding the ignition devices. But then if you click on that for an expansion, even today, as I sit here testifying, the expansion of that summary catch line says that the bill increases fees for driving under the influence of intoxicants, screening, interview, and diagnostic assessment. It leaves any member of the legislature who is contemplating how to vote on this bill with the impression that our fees are still going to be increased. We have worked in several sessions in the past to try and get a fee raised through this legislature. And I believe that there are people that would vote on the basis of the fact that they see this increases our fee. They would vote in favor of that bill on the Senate floor, not knowing that, in fact, it does not support the ADIS. In fact, it absolutely will bring their demise. The last document that I wanted to share with you that is for people that are in the treatment field and in the ADIS field. We periodically get legislative updates from addictions and mental health. This is the update that I received on the internet from the legislative coordinator for addictions and mental health. It describes Senate Bill 397, which defines a negative report and provides for petition for IID removal after 6 months of no reports. House Judiciary, Room 343. There is nothing in that description that tells anybody in the treatment field or the ADIS field or the court system, if they are part of that list of people who received this email, that this bill is going to destroy the impact, destroy the ADIS position. I am a very small agency in a rural county. I don't have a lot of volumes of clients coming through my office. It is very, very difficult for me to maintain my practice. If this bill passes, I'm done. I will professionally and appropriately close my doors. I am not waiting for an interim session after almost 11 years of asking for a fee raise. I'm not going there. There is no reason. ADISons have done a great job. We cost you no money. There is no reason why our fees should not be increased. I beg you to make the amendment that Senator Thatcher attached, but give us a fee raise. Make it a cost of living increase, retroactive to 2004, effective till today with an automatic increase. Give us a fee for monitoring on the IID devices for those who do monitor that. To ask us to work for free. Now, Gail Meyer mentioned that under the new bill, we wouldn't be monitoring on the ignition interlock devices. That is not the case. If you read on page 2, the first sentence in there says that the reports from the provider are going to be sent to the court that required the device to be installed or the court's designee. That's us. Our work is still going to go on, and we need to be paid for that work. I don't want to beg, but I'm telling you, this has reached critical mass for me. I cannot any longer do this job. I'm going to be reporting to the Polk County Circuit Court, Monmouth Municipal Court, Dallas Municipal Court, Independence Municipal Court, that I'm done. And they will have no alternative because I'm the last person standing as an ADIS in Polk County. Everyone else long ago closed their doors out of financial necessity. That is the end of my testimony. I appreciate your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'll answer.
Thank you very much for your testimony. It's important to hear from you today. We obviously, I don't think enough people that do this, and we're waiting for the amendments and see what else will happen. And so thank you again. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 397A and announce that we were rolling over 908, the bill that has to do with people being able to expunge their record. The work session will be rolled over to tomorrow.
That's it.
If we stand adjourned, thank you. If we stand adjourned, thank you.